At Ferguson's assumption of office, you mentioned that you had discussed the matter kind of in a pro forma way with the Chancellor Cutler, and that there was at no time a wider range of possibilities than Ferguson because of Banfield's interest. What did you see Ferguson doing? I think we've already discussed the five personnel actions, which seemed very firm and determined when they were initially announced to the press, but kind of evolved over a period of next year as the board had a chance to reconsider those. Like maybe just a general question, how would you characterize Ferguson's presidency and maybe vis-a-vis Hollinger? It seems that Hollinger and Miller had been principals of the cash flow problem, and in essence ended up being the real principals of at least a portion of the deficit spending which occurred in June of 77.
I would characterize Ferguson's 6 months as president as an additional 6 month period of time where the university lost ground. I can't think of one redeeming occurrence during that 6 months. I characterize it, and you know, I've always been candid, and I will continue to be candid. I characterize it this way. The board exacted from Ferguson a promise prior to naming him interim president that under no circumstances would he consider himself to be a candidate and would he seek to continue in office. He acknowledged that request with vehement agreement and promises. And I would say that within seconds after he was named interim president, he embarked on a 6-month-long effort to become the full-time permanent president of the University of Alaska forever. I did not, this might be one of the understatements of the afternoon, I would not consider Ferguson to be an honorable person in that regard and others. Put simply, in terms of Hollinger and Miller, I don't know, to this day I don't understand how Ferguson could have made this mistake, but Ferguson saw himself as totally and completely dependent upon Hollinger and Miller, that the only hope for salvation from the abyss of fiscal irregularity and incompetence and so forth was to keep Hollinger and Miller in there pecking away. I mean, you'd have to have been a complete imbecile to think this, I think. Hollinger was obviously biding time. He had resigned, but like most people who had used and raped this university, his resignation was given the tail end of 1 year and effective the end of the next year. So he picked up, in their adopting it, he picked up a year. Incidentally, let me digress quickly and say that's exactly the same number that Hyatt did on the board. At the Bethel meeting, when Hyatt announced his resignation effective at the end of the five-year period, and the board accepted it, they in effect gave him a contract for that full period, which is one of the reasons why he could not have resigned unless he chose to do it. In February of 77, he could only step down because the board had already accepted his retirement effective 1979. So anyway, get back to Ferguson. Hollinger should have, in my opinion, been immediately relieved of duty and let go. You could not have fallen further behind by bringing in anybody to replace Max. Max had, even if he ever had a ghost to give up, he had, you know, a fiscal control ghost, he had certainly given it up at that point. He was not a serious vice president. He was still sloughing off most of the responsibilities, in my opinion, and turning them over to Miller, which was, again, in my opinion, a compounding of the problem, because I think Miller had, among other things, serious problems which went beyond his capabilities as a person charged with any kind of a fiscal responsibility for an organization of this type. So you had really, one thinks of the old blind leading the blind kind of a situation. They both should have been let go and an immediate search begun for a replacement. Most people don't know this and would find it hard to believe. Ferguson was so beholden to Hollinger that even after Hollinger's contract ran out, Ferguson actually entertained and brought up before certain members of the board the idea of keeping Hollinger on as a consultant. Needless to say, that never happened. But he was totally dependent upon Hollinger and Miller for what he viewed any salvation in terms of the fiscal problems. And I think it was, in a way, sad. You know, it indicated two things. It indicated a myriad of things, but basically two things. One, Ferguson didn't have the slightest notion of the fiscal problems or the extent of them or how to get a hold of them, and he was hence so dependent on Hollinger. And Hollinger couldn't have cared less. He was so close to his retirement that it didn't matter one way or the other. So here you have a totally dependent person who knew only a third of what he should have known to be doing his job, and a person who was biding time. They rode out for a 6-month period that way. So the question was there any improvement? And as I started out this segment of the interview, no, in my opinion, the university lost considerable ground under Ferguson in 6 months rather than picking up some ground in the wake of Hyatt's stepping down and so forth. We lost ground, certainly lost ground in the deficit.
How would you... I think the deficit just seems to be another symptom of a management style of that Max entertained. Did he operate relatively independent of both Hyatt and Ferguson in terms of utilizing money? Maybe one of my perceptions of the time was that that there was a vacuum in governance and that the governance of the university was kind of manipulated by the vice president for finance by his being able to give money or take away money. That, you know, that's, I think, not a good or a wise way to manage by having a staff officer with finance control.
I would say basically you're right. Yes and no. Max Hollinger, in my opinion, did have too much control as a staff officer. I don't allow, or I didn't, when I was president, I didn't allow Sherman Carter to have one-third as much authority as Max assumed for himself. And keeping Sherman Carter from having authority is like holding back a dinosaur, you know, with a thread. Sherman is just a go kind of a person. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think Max kept himself in some kind of a position of authority by withholding information from his superiors and making them totally dependent upon him for what little information they had in terms of the fiscal operation of the university. Needless to say, you can only do that when the person from whom you're holding information doesn't know anything about the fiscal operations, period. And, of course, that was certainly the case with those two people, certainly Hyatt and Ferguson. And then he also curried favor with individual people around the university by dispensing certain kinds of fiscal favors. I don't necessarily mean illegal. There may have been a couple of those, too, in terms of being questionable, but just favors. And I have characterized the year-end debacle as... in fact, I think in discussion with you at one time, I said it was like the Pasha coming out to his people on the tufted pillows at the end of the year and saying, in effect, and what would you like, my friend? You know, what can I do for you for your continued support? That's exactly what happened to the Geophysical Institute with their, and they were totally innocent, but I mean, that's how they got their electronic microscope. Ferguson was sitting there on his theoretical tufted pillows at the end of the fiscal year. He was already in deficit, but neither he or Hollinger even knew it, or at least Hollinger claimed not to know it. He's already in deficit, and they proceeded to dole out $2-3 million additional dollars. Trucks to certain units of the university, automobiles. Ferguson even bought himself an automobile and conspired with Hilliard and Harry Keim to hide it in a warehouse down on lower campus and spirited away to Juneau when Ferguson was reassigned. And again, I would not commit that kind of information to this record unless it was substantiated. But the Geophysical Institute, in effect, the issue was posed to them. Well, you've always wanted one of these, you know, $100,000, I think $85,000 electron microscopes. Well, now, my friends, you have it. And it was at that time when Ferguson, very, very sad situation. I really mean that. Ferguson was still trying desperately to somehow emerge as the permanent president of this university. As a matter of fact, even after the board appointed Neil Humphrey, effective, I guess, August 12th or whatever it was, I can say from a visual observation, Ferguson did not still believe that he was out. He thought something would happen. And I definitely believe that the Bell's palsy that he developed upon leaving office was directly related to the emotional letdown of thinking that he was going to continue as president. And it was a sad thing to see this man with a facial tic and, you know, a twisting of the head and neck and so forth kind of leave office with his tail between his legs and amidst a scandalous situation of a deficit and so forth. So it was definitely the university lost 6 months of ground and then some.
I know. I guess my perception or what I had heard was that they were still contemplating making improvements, personal improvements in the home right up till the time when they left, and that there was a reality that didn't seem apparent.
Absolutely. And there was let me take a side path here in my own case. When the board named me president and stipulated a term effective June 30th, 79, I went home that night, and the second thing I said to my wife, okay, was, don't get used to it. And we used to remind ourselves of that back and forth, because you can fall right into any kind of a pattern. And certainly my, which ended up to be almost 21 months, was a lot longer than Ferguson's 6 months. And we used to kid back and forth and say, don't get used to it, don't get used to it. And we didn't. And it was a much easier transition for me to make. Surely I would have liked to have been president for another 10 years, you know, and I would certainly not roam around suggesting that wouldn't be the case. But you're right. Ferguson never really would accept the fact, even after Neil Humphrey was appointed on August, 11th or 12th, whatever it was. And was contemplating, as you said, improvements in the house and buying that car that he bought. That was destined to be the new car here, you know, for to be used by someone. He had priced, you know, things and cars, and it was a sad, pathetic thing. By that time, incidentally, there was no support on the board for Ferguson. In fact, the only advice I ever gave Ferguson, he asked for it. He asked me once what is the secret in getting along with certain board members who didn't like him? And you don't have to be a wizard to figure out who that one board member from Anchorage was. And I said to Ferguson, Chuck, you would make a big mistake if you try to turn around that board member. That board member is not going to get along with you no matter what happens. I said, what you should do is to try to uphold the faith put in you by those board members that supported you, because if you don't, there is no wrath like a person who has been cheated in that way. And let me tell you, my friend, that's exactly the way it went. Those board members, particularly that one, Regent Banfield, their wrath towards Ferguson was like no other wrath on that board, because they had supported him and he had cheated them. He had made promises and so forth and didn't live up to them.
The Board of Regents, what was their position in this interim? They had appointed Ferguson. I believe like in May he made an announcement that we had in fact either closed the cash flow problem and things looked rosy. It was subsequently announced that we had gone and not only had a problem with cash flow but deficit spending. Were they becoming or had they become disenchanted with Hullinger and Miller, and was there kind of still a paralysis in terms of the board's ability to react to the crisis?
I think some members of the board early on in Ferguson's six-month career as president believed him. I think that was a lesser number than those who didn't believe him. And I guess I would be dishonest if I didn't point out that I was close enough to the situation at that time. One of the things Ferguson had tried to do in an undercurrent kind of a way was to get rid of me with the board. And I will say that that didn't go anywhere with the board at all, because I think the board had a great, well, obviously they had a lot of faith in me, or they wouldn't have named me president subsequent to that. But the one thing the board knew was that I was loyal and honest, and I guess knowledgeable. And they knew that I would never lie to them. I would never put them in an inappropriate position in terms of being a staff to the member to the board and doing something that was not appropriate and defensible with their chief executive, the president. And despite all the rumor and suggestions to the contrary, I would like to have anyone come forward with anything that suggested that during Hyatt's presidency, Ferguson's and Humphrey, that I did anything that could be considered to be unprofessional or because I didn't do that. And one of the reasons why was not because I'm the hero of the year, but because it will not work any other way. The chief executive officer, he's the worst one in the world, is the chief executive officer and must be left to do unto himself what has to be done. Anyway, get back to the thing with Ferguson. I didn't feel the same kind of a thing with Ferguson because he was an interim president, and there's a big difference between being the president and being an interim president. Part of the charge to Ferguson as an interim president, incidentally, interim was his word. The board wanted an acting, and Ferguson, for some incredible reason, I don't know, I mean, I'm an English major, I don't know what, but he claimed that interim was a better word than acting and gave him more authority. That logic has escaped me all these years, but nonetheless, part of the charge to him basically was, don't get carried away now, Chuck, just hold things together while we search for a president. Let me hasten to point out that was exactly the opposite of the charge given to me when they named me president. That was, you're president, that's why we're naming you president and not interim president. Go do it. And do it up until the day when a replacement arrives. So there was quite a difference there. Well, obviously that's not what Ferguson did. He began to move full speed ahead. He held a press conference and announced that the labor problems had been solved and he had signed an agreement. My God, he almost gave away the university in that labor agreement. $500,000 daycare center proposal down in Anchorage, which was hidden, wasn't even a part of the contract brought before the board for them to look at. Made these announcements, an open door policy. My God, it was a laughing stock issue in the central office. Ferguson's open door meant that Bob Hilliard can come in and out, and no one else, and occasionally Max and Larry Miller. So, you know, he just embarked on this program, which was so obvious to everyone. I mean, it was just pathetic. Most of the legislature were aware of it, certainly the Commissioner of Administration, with whom I have had a multitude of subsequent discussions, where they were all aware of it. And I guess the game plan there was just ride it out and get a replacement and get him out of there. Actually, he did more harm than most people thought he could do. The deficit alone, the university, this university will suffer because of that deficit. My guess would be for a decade. You won't be able to make up the lost ground, because I'm sure you can put it together. I came in as president and saved an amount of money equal to the deficit to try to offset it, which actually only means, in terms of looking at the university over a long haul for 10 years or so, as twice that amount of money taken out of the university. Now, not literally twice, because the deficit was created by spending more than you really had, so you kind of made a gain there. But just in terms of the credibility and then so forth, it was just a devastating thing. Anyway, that's kind of a expanded answer to a simple question.
I guess we should move on to the Humphrey presidency. You were, assume, an active part of the region's effort to search for a new president, and
I was just staff. I did all the staff work, and the board had named Sam Keto as chairman of the search committee. Briefly stated, I think it was a good search. There were a lot of comments made about this last search, where this was so much of a better search and done much less expensively. Curiously enough, and you know, you may go over and look into this, curiously enough, it bottomed out spending the same amount of money and having less candidates. There were, as I can recall at this point, something in the neighborhood of 115 or so candidates that time, and narrowed the field down to 15, then 10, then 5, and so forth. Humphrey was consistently the first choice of the board. There was not a situation where candidate X was their choice, but candidate X wouldn't come. There were two or three board members that had hung in there for Don Schwartz as a kind of a second choice, but Humphrey was unanimous choice after a couple of hours of discussion, and so named the president. He could not come right away, if you'll recall, and Tim Tillsworth and I were put in some kind of a funny coordinating role of holding things together for about a month. And then Humphrey came, I guess, around mid-September or something. In fact, I think there was a board meeting that he just came up to. Neil Humphrey and I became almost instant friends. I've heard all sorts of incredible rumors to the contrary, but they were just not true. As a matter of fact, I communicate still with Neil. I wouldn't say regularly, but you know, we write back and forth and so forth. Neil was an interesting guy. I think one of his problems, if you want to characterize it as a problem, was that he came from a very tight kind of a ship. He operated out of a very small office in Reno, one single building in Reno, probably six so people on the staff. And yes, he was the chancellor in the Nevada system, but the Nevada system consisted of the campus at Vegas and the campus in Reno, and in the desert research station. You don't need me to tell you that the campus at Vegas is totally and completely under control of the president there, as is the campus in Reno. And so his role was chiefly, and I'm not minimizing it, but chiefly one of coordinating the adherence of the two units of the university to the regent's policy, which basically is what any chancellor or, of a statewide system does. And he came into this, and I really don't think Neil had even close to a full realization of the extent of the problems here. And I remember during the interviewing process and Neil talking to me, I remember telling him, but I had the feeling when I told him that Neil had a tendency to think, well, you know, this is how this situation is perceived by people who don't have the kinds of experience from the top that I have. And I think that's a fairly normal way to look at it. I mean, you come in here and somebody with a fluky title, Executive Secretary of the Board of Regents, is telling you, you know, some of these horror stories. Because one thing the board didn't want to do was to mislead anyone and suggest that, you know, we didn't really have too much in the way of problems. Anyway, Neil came. Neil was a very, very proud person. And I think that was one of his problems, because I think he found himself suddenly in, up to his waist in muck and mire, and felt that his pride, his ego, his status as a respected chief administrator was going to get hopelessly tarnished by the problems here. And I think basically, there are a lot of other reasons, basically that's what caused his almost immediate resignation, which, what was it, three months later. I think that was it. I think he felt that for example, that there was a good possibility that there would be legal ramifications coming out of the Ferguson 6 month, which I like to characterize as a debacle. He felt that there were the potential for all sorts of legal problems existed there. He saw some of the problems as he was quoted as being irreversible. Thought the situation with the legislature was beyond redemption. He was not emotionally prepared to deal with the kind of treatment that he received from this legislature. Now, these are my views of, from my view. One of the first things that Neil and I discussed was whether or not I would come to work in the administration. As I said to you earlier, that had been something that I always would have liked to have done. And the board, on the one hand, agreed and thought that Neil's suggestion was a good one, but on the other hand, they were still a little reluctant. And as boards are wont to do, they they said, well, we'll get the both best worlds. And if you'll recall, I was half-time special assistant to the president and half-time executive secretary to the board, a position which most people felt would be impossible to do because they saw these as conflicting kinds of positions. I really didn't. As a matter of fact, it was probably a good kind of a transition because one of the things that probably a special assistant to the president could have continued to do on a full-time basis would be to attend to board affairs in terms of the mechanics of their meetings and so forth. So that was a very interesting 3 or 4 month period for me. Most of the responsibilities at that point were in the collective bargaining personnel and so forth, and you know whatever other space, whatever other tasks needed to be done. The central office was woefully understaffed then, probably still is, and there was a desperate need for help in there, and that was, I'm sure, part of Neil's wisdom. But anyway, I think if he had stayed, I think he probably could have had some success with the situation. I think his leaving was ill-advised, premature, but his decision to make. And incidentally, I think a much tougher one to make than to stay. I think the situation here was almost bad enough, you know, where he could have been hacking away at it for 3 or 4 years and nobody would have faulted him. I think it was a tough position to take because Neil didn't even have a job. Now, he had a suggestion of a job. This job in Youngstown was still vacant, and they had, I think people had been interested in him coming there. But he was prepared to just give it all up. He went back to Reno for a while, I think stayed with friends, and then, you know, if you'll recall that business where he was kind of a consultant with the Nevada system for a month, and that kind of fell apart, cost some chancellor down there his job or a president. Yeah. And then, of course, he went on to Youngstown. But anyway, his departure kind of left me as a special assistant and Tim Tillsworth as the assistant for academic affairs and VP Brewer and Grunig. That was, you know, basically it.
Was it, is it your understanding that, I guess, well, let me put it this way. One of the perceptions I had was that maybe Neil Humphrey saw it as a fiscal crisis and not really as a real management, basic management crisis, and that his own experience with a decentralized, well-running system was one of, you know, logic and deciding and playing conservative role fiscally, but that he was unprepared for the political problems in Alaska in terms of the legislature's involvement or interest in the process.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the things that began to become not apparent, but there was a suggestion of its becoming apparent, was that some people would jokingly say Neil Humphrey really doesn't need a vice president for finance because he's going to run that show himself. And, of course, if you were talking to Earl Brewer right now, you'd get that in spades. Earl used to say that. He doesn't need me. He's going to make all of his own fiscal determinations, and he did. Pretty much. So I think you're right. I think he was, you know, his history was the director of budget in Nevada. You know, any director of budget knows how you have to play it with the legislature and so forth. He was a fiscal conservative. He was pretty much liked by the Nevada legislature. He had some problems, but that's going to happen. And I think you're right. I have never speculated on that because there wasn't really enough time for it to manifest itself, and I'd rather not speculate at his expense. But I suppose I shall now. I would say that, yes, there was every possibility that he would have had problems once the fiscal operation was caught up and smoothed out. He would have had problems managing this place. If you'll hearken back to what I said earlier about the distinction between working presidencies and non-working presidencies, I don't think he was a good manager. One thing, he was incredibly secretive. He'd go into his office and shut the door and consult with no one and come out 2 days later with a whole raft of policies on, for example, his policy on going to per diem rather than direct expense. That's cost the university tens of thousands of dollars. It did not save money to go on per diem. But he felt it did because they were on per diem in Nevada. He didn't consult with anyone. He just came forward with that policy to the board. Another one was relatively unimportant, but in Nevada, it's against the law to use public funds to buy alcohol. We came out with a policy, you know, henceforth, nobody in the university could buy alcohol with public money. Well, it's not against the law in Alaska. And I think you have a different kind of a situation here. And I think, both professionally and morally, I don't think there's anything wrong with chancellors and other people who are so authorized to be able to buy wine, beer, and whatnot for social events and other liquor and so forth. That was another thing where he didn't consult. So he gave some indications to me of being a strange kind of a manager. Now, again, those were some hectic times, and I've always been reluctant to look at the situation during those times and make some long-standing judgments. Take with a grain of salt or two what I've said about him. But that, I'm inclined to agree with you that he was very strong fiscally and saw some things happening on that side of the fence that he never envisioned and could not comprehend and wanted to get out right away. And I'm adding to it and saying that even if he had stuck it out and overcame those problems, he might have had a raft of others because of his management style.
Yeah, I think you perhaps want to discuss this later about almost everybody's involvement in the political process in Alaska and given university
one of my
people.
Pets.
You're right, university.
Real.
Okay.